Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode If You Could Hide to Colab podcast. Clive, super excited to be here today and talk about Easter.
Yeah, it's a great episode today, and welcome, everybody. And if it's the first time listening, welcome to the podcast. You're tuned in at the right time. You know, Easter special, it's always exciting. The Atonement, it's a massive, massive lesson that I think it's something we'll never be able to cover in any of our episodes, all in one episode.
Well, that's right. I think we're going to try to cover a bit today, but we really encourage you to look at what we're going to talk about, but look at the gaps as well and really try to fill your own knowledge and try to grow your own knowledge base with as much of this story as possible. And I think that's really how people can grow their testimonies and grow an appreciation for the story.
I agree. Well said. I actually have a quote to start us off, if
okay.
you don't mind.
Great. Go for it.
So this is from an institute manual back when I was in institute back in 2011. It says...
Throwback.
No doctrine in the gospel is more important than the atonement of Jesus Christ. If the gospel were compared to a wheel, the atonement would be the hub, and all of the doctrines would be the spokes emanating from the hub. The fundamental principles of our religion are the testimony of the apostles and prophets concerning Jesus Christ, that he died, was buried, and rose again the third day, and ascended into heaven. And all other things which pertain to our religion are only appendages of it.
Yeah, great. Okay, great to start us off with. Well, the thing that I actually wanted to start the lesson today is the Articles of Faith.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. Let's go to the Articles of Faith. And it's, you know, as primary, we memorize them. Do they still memorize them in primary?
Well, actually, I'm going through that with my kids right now.
Oh, well, you know it then. Yeah. So is this just a test? All right. Well, let's read the first, second, and third article of faith. Why don't you read the first two, I'll read the last one.
Sure. We believe in God, the Eternal Father, and in His Son, Jesus Christ, and in the Holy Ghost.
You got that right. Well done.
Perfect. Okay. Second one. We believe that men will be punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgression.
And the third one, we believe that through the atonement of Christ, all mankind may be saved by obedience to the laws and ordinances of the gospel. So why I thought we would start with them is that I feel like these first three articles of faith summarize essentially our religion.
Right.
They summarize that we believe in a God, we believe he is our eternal father, and we believe in that we have a Christ that's saving us. And we believe as well that the atonement is required because of the fall. Right. So
right. Yeah.
What I'm thinking is the fall is the father of the atonement.
Right.
The fall needed to happen. And as soon as the fall occurs, as soon as Adam and Eve are removed from the garden, from that very moment onwards, the atonement is required.
See, it's funny you say that, because when I was studying for this lesson,
yeah,
I couldn't quite figure out where to start. Because at first I went, okay, the atonement, Garden of Gethsemane. And then I went, well, actually, it was before that. It was Jesus' ministry. The whole thing was leading up to it. And I thought, well, it's actually before that. There's the wickedness and the reason for the atonement. And then I'm like, well, hold on. Then there's Adam and Eve. But then it was foreordained before the world began, and I was just like, all of a sudden I was down this hole going, where do I start the atonement from?
Where does the atonement start?
Where does the atonement start?
Yeah, well, I think if we split it from a earthly perspective, in my opinion, the atonement starts like Garden of Eden is finished, and then we're on. Bruce R. McConkie talked about the three gardens. He talked about Garden of Eden, Garden of Gethsemane, and then Garden of the Empty Tomb. And when he's talking about the atonement, the Garden of Eden is a place. Once the Garden of Eden ends, we needed to move to the Garden of Gethsemane. And then when that occurs, we need to move to the Garden of the Empty Tomb, which is when the atonement is done. So kind of each one is needing the next. And so he really talks about it very well. April 85 is the talk. He explains it so well that each area is a place in time that preceded, like the Garden of Gethsemane is needed because of what happened in Eden. The Garden of the Empty Tomb is what's needed because of Gethsemane. And so it's a requirement from way back, way, way, way back when.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah, that's a good way to put it, I guess, because, I mean, if we're talking about the actual physical act of Christ performing the atonement, because, I mean, the atonement, it's now on to us to continue on, you know, acting upon the things that Christ did for us. So I guess his job was done after the empty tomb, that's what you're saying?
Yeah.
The empty tomb is, his part is done, now it's really on us.
Right, yeah. Right. And we've been learning about sacrifice for a really, really long time. And that's the other thing that I thought I would start in this lesson, that we, as a people, we're trying to convince the rest of the world that Christ died for our sins. And it's not just randomly a person it partakes in this act. We've been teaching it, the Lord through his servants have been teaching sacrifice forever. For like literally forever. And if we go to Moses, maybe I'll get you to and you can kind of see what I mean here. I might actually go to first thing. Can you go to Moses 5?
Yep.
If you go to Moses 5 and it's verse 6 and 7, and I might go to Nephi.
Can you just read it?
Yes, I've got mine. Yeah, if you read Moses
5, 6 and 7.
Go.
And after many days, an angel of the Lord appeared unto Adam, saying, Why doest thou offer sacrifices unto the Lord? And Adam said unto him, I know not, save the Lord commanded me. And the angel spake, saying, This thing is a similitude of the sacrifice of the only begotten of the Father, which is full of grace and truth.
Right. And so this is, Adam and Eve are out of the garden, and immediately Adam is offering sacrifice. And he doesn't know why, but he knows that he needs to. He's commanded to, and he knows that he needs to. And it's not till a later on in time where an angel appears to him and actually teaches him why he's doing it. So for eons, we've been doing sacrifice. You'll remember in 1 Nephi 5, when Nephi and his brothers finally come back with the plates, Sarai was stressed. She then receives a witness that what they're doing is as per the Lord. Lehi teaches a great lesson. And what does he do? He offers sacrifice, and they give thanks to God. And all of these sacrifices are in similitude of what's going to happen. Jacob 5 talks about it as well. Alma talks about it as well. And even further than that, we don't even have to stay in our canon. We don't even have to stay in our version of scriptures. We can go to Abraham and Isaac. And that was a sacrifice that was in similitude of what's going to happen in thousands of years later. So even in our non-scriptures, in, you know, anyone can access the King James Bible, right? It's a common. It talks about it there. So we've been doing it forever, is the point that I wanted to raise.
Actually, I have something on that. Joseph Smith taught about Adam and Eve, like what you mentioned, Adam and Eve, they were performing these sacrifices. And yeah, first of all, they said, well, we don't know why we're doing it, but we just know the Lord's commanded it. And Joseph Smith actually says this concerning that. He says, it is evident in our minds that he was, speaking of Adam, that he was instructed more fully in the plan than the Bible speaks of. For how could he offer a sacrifice in faith, looking to God for remission of his sins in the power for the great atonement, without having been previously instructed of the plan? And further, if he was accepted of God, what were the ordinances performed further than the offering of the firstlings of the flock?
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, Adam obviously didn't know at first, but he was obviously taught later on.
He was taught what to do.
Yeah, and like you said, that's the beginning. You know, that's the beginning of it all.
Yeah.
So we don't offer sacrifices now in the same way, but it's always been done up to Christ.
Okay, so I thought next that maybe we'll go to Matthew and we'll start with the story.
Okay.
And what I wouldn't mind doing is, I hope I've got this marked properly, I have, mercifully. We know in the scriptures, so Christ is out teaching people for a couple of years, and there's an attempt, Mark records an attempt for the high priest that they want to take Christ, and that's an unsuccessful mission from them. But there's a point in time where they say, that's it, no more, we're taking this guy. We're taking him. And so I just wanted to read that out. So if we go to Matthew chapter 26, and it starts at verse 1, and this is the point in time where the high priests and all the scribes say, that's it, it's not happening. This guy cannot continue. This is an issue for us. So I'll just read it out. It's not too much, but it starts at verse 1. It came to pass when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said unto his disciples, ye know that after 2 days is the feast of the Passover, and the Son of Man is betrayed to be crucified. Then assembled together the chief priests and the scribes and the elders of the people unto the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas. Are you saying Caiphas?
That's Caiphas. How I read it, yeah.
And consulted that they might take Jesus by subtlety and kill him. But they said, not on the feast day, lest there be an uproar amongst the people. So this is the point in time where they say, done. We're not dealing with this anymore. They've been watching Christ do all these miracles.
Yeah.
Right? They've watched him. There's the fishes and loaves story. There's blind, there's a million miracles.
Well, the blind man, you know, Christ said, don't tell anyone, and he went off and told everyone.
Right.
So straight away, you know, people are going to learn.
And they're seeing as well, these people who are high in the community, they're not elected officials. Their prerogative is to try and stay in power. That's what they need to do. If they're not in power anymore, if someone else is in power, well, that's a disaster for them. They don't want to be with the scum on the ground and having to steal bread. Like, they want to keep their power. And so they've got high frustration now, and they can't deal with it anymore. So how did we get to this stage? Well, if we go to John 11, it's the story of Lazarus.
Right.
Right. So the story of Lazarus is fairly well known. Essentially, Lazarus is a relation to Martha.
Martha and Mary.
And Martha and Mary, yeah. So it says here, therefore his sisters sent unto him, saying, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. So Christ loves these people. He is friends with them. He is close with them. And Lazarus is dead. And they say, and they're imploring Christ to do something about it, because they're past the point of faith. They know that Christ can do all things.
Yep.
And so they come to him and say, we need you to help. We can't bear that this is happening, and we need you to help. And there's a few questions back and forth, actually, and there's a lesson here for the disciples where Christ says that he's sleeping, and then in the end they say, well, howbeit Jesus spake of his death, but they thought that he had spoken of taking of rest in sleep. So Christ is saying he's sleeping, and the disciples are going, well, what do you mean? And then in the end he has to say, then this is in verse 14, then Jesus said unto them plainly, Lazarus is dead. So Jesus acknowledges that Lazarus is dead. There's no, in the Jewish world, there's not a real clarity on the afterlife. There's some text around a sort of a hell, but not really. There's no clear what's going to happen next.
And you got to think as well, Jesus would have been teaching Mary and Martha constantly, so they would understand that the resurrection will come about, but not until after Jesus. So I suppose Mary's thinking, well, he's dead now, and he's not going to be resurrected, because the resurrection doesn't exist yet.
And that actually reminds me, in verse 4, when Jesus heard that he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified thereby. So Christ knows as well, he's sad, but he knows that this is happening for the glory of God, and that the Son of God might be glorified.
Right.
So if we move to verse 43, Christ is now about to perform the miracle. And when he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave cloths. And his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus saith unto them, loose him and let him go. Lazarus has been brought back from the dead. And there is so many people around. This amazing miracle has occurred. Mary and Martha, there must have just been absolute shock and elation. There's great paintings of this scene, and it must have just been a like, if you're watching that, like, what are you thinking?
Yeah.
Like, it must have just been strange. Anyway, so back to my point. Why now? So why now did they say no more? Christ can't continue. Well, this is easy to read here in verse 47. Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees in council and said, "What do we do? For this man doeth many miracles. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation."
Right.
So the chief priests and the Pharisees have just watched Lazarus come back from the dead after being dead for 4 days. And they're stunned. They believe. They've watched it. What do we do? This man doeth many miracles. And then immediately that issue of selfishness, I guess, arrogance maybe, they go, right, as soon as people start this word, there's 100 people around, as soon as this word gets out and people don't just hear that the miracles are happening, but they can now see Lazarus. This is game over for us. And so this is the point in time. So then, then we fast forward a good 5 days, and this is where we then get Matthew 26, where they gather themselves together and they say, "That's it, it's done. Like, right, we are now doing this. We believe that this guy can do miracles." And they had this amazing opportunity, of course, to go, "Well, let's follow him." Like, yeah, they could have easily said, "Lazarus has come back from the dead. Let's follow him. Let's follow Christ. What an amazing miracle. Surely if we get behind this guy, we're going to be right."
But because Christ loves the poor and needy, you know, the ones that can't take care of themselves, they're probably thinking, if people start to follow him, us, the rich guys, we're going to be put down at the bottom.
That's right. There's going to be no need for us.
Yeah.
We're ruling out of fear. The people are fearful of us. And if they no longer fear us, they'll no longer respect our position. If they don't respect our position, how can we collect taxes?
Yep.
How can we walk down the street and then be scared of us and clean up as we walk through? Or we just go and get whatever we want and take anything from the shops, go to the temples whenever we like, treat people however we like. It's just not going
to
happen.
So our best option is to kill Jesus.
Our best option to stay in this
cut it off
communal status.
Yep.
He's got to go.
Wow.
We need to get him out of the picture, because this lavish life we're living is under threat.
Yep.
So then 6 days before the Passover, so we know that was, so this is Shabbat, or the eve of Shabbat, I believe. We get the spikenard story. And so this is Mary, who is honoring Christ in the best way she knows how. He's in the house with Lazarus is there as well. He's in the house and they're essentially having some kind of dinner, supper. And Mary takes this, what's referred to as costly, this ointment, this very, very special ointment. And she takes it out and she honors Christ by washing him with it and using her own hair. Actually, in Jesus the Christ, talks about that it's something that's very rarely even goes to a king. Like, it's a really, really high honor.
Right.
And this is now where Judas comes into the story. So we've got a couple of main points here that I'm just trying to talk through. We've got the Lazarus is the linchpin for that's it, Christ has got to go. And now where does Judas come into it? Well, Judas comes into it in this story. So Judas gets jealous, I'm not sure, but he certainly finds frustration that Mary has used this ointment that he can sell. And he has a little bit of a snide comment, actually. He says here in chapter 12, verse 5, "Why was not this ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the bag and bare what was put therein." So Judas has the bag. What's the bag? Judas's job was to have the money. He was the bag carrier. He had the money, so he was the one that his heart is set on riches, and he's carrying the bag. So he doesn't care for the poor. He actually wanted 300 more pence in his kitty, in yep. his bank, in his purse, perhaps.
So he wasn't much different to the Pharisees that were sort of taken over, really.
Right.
He had the same mindset. How can I make more money?
How can I get more money?
Yeah.
And you've it goes to show the contempt that he has for Christ, that he's seeing that Christ has performed these miracles and now feels like honoring him was a total waste of money.
Yeah.
Like, could have done something so much better with the ointment. So a really, really important story there. So point I'm making is this is where Judas makes his appearance.
Right.
So now if we go to Luke 22, we start seeing the story evolve. So Judas now, so we're kind of skipping days. I think this is probably what I was thinking about when I mentioned at the start, if people who are listening or following along, we're skipping days. There's so much that happens on each day.
Yeah, we don't have time to cover it. But yeah, there's a lot. We really want to stick to the key points.
Right. So in 22 now, Luke chapter 22, verse 3, then entered Satan into Judas, surnamed Iscariot, being of the number of the 12. He went his way and communed with the chief priests and captains, how he might betray him unto them. And they were glad and covenanted to give him money, and promised and sought opportunity to betray him unto them in the absence of the multitude. So we're fast forwarding here to the Passover, essentially.
Yeah. With Judas, I mean, it's interesting because Judas knows the doctrine. He's been taught by Christ, and it's been prophesied for a long time that someone will betray Christ. And it's just an interesting thing that he hasn't gone, oh, it's been prophesied.
Right.
You know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. You know, and I just think it's interesting, even down to the fact that it was 30 pieces of silver, you know, when he negotiates the money, even that was prophesied. That was prophesied in Zechariah 11, verse 12. It says, so this is prophesying of when Christ comes. And I said unto them, if ye think good, give me my price, and if not, forbear. So they weighed for my price 30 pieces of silver. So he's prophesying there that somebody is going to go and betray Christ, and they're going to say, you know, what's the price of Christ to you? 30 pieces of silver. And this came about. This prophecy came about. Judas knows about it.
Do you reckon he understood the scriptures then? He knows that was him?
I mean, I don't...
Did he know it?
Maybe he didn't know that specifically, but surely he knew the prophecy that Christ was to come down and he would die for our sins because somebody's going to betray him and he'll eventually die on the cross, because the cross is spoken about as well in the scriptures.
Well, even that just reminded me of Psalms 41. Yea, mine own familiar friend in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me.
Right.
So it is you're right, it is prophesied, even down to the 30 pieces.
Yeah, it's just an interesting thought that it was so, I don't mind doing this.
Yeah.
Even though it's been prophesied for so long, and of course he was with Christ the whole time.
The scriptures tell us, so this is now on the, we're now on Thursday.
Right.
We're now on Thursday before Friday.
Yeah.
The scriptures now tell us that Christ knew what was going on, and it says somewhere in here, I don't remember, but somewhere in these, it says that Christ walked no more with the people.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so he actually... The Passover, the Jewish tradition of the Passover is that you need at least 10 people to sit down at a table and to have the Passover. And Christ didn't even organize. There's actually an interesting story about how it all came about. So
the night of the Passover?
The night of the Passover. But something interesting just to note as well, like you said, it's Thursday.
Yes.
So it's April 6th.
Right.
Which also known as 14
Nisan. Yeah. Jewish month. Jewish months. The Jewish month of, in this particular occasion is Nisan. But that does change. Yeah, it's lunar, so it does change a little.
That's right. But the Jewish days consist of, as soon as the nighttime falls and you first see three stars, that is the next day. So the night. So our Wednesday night ends Thursday morning, I suppose, just starts whenever you wake up. Now it's Thursday.
But sure.
In Jewish tradition, it was as soon as the night falls and you see the first three stars, that becomes the next day.
Right. So the night of, so Thursday night is Friday.
Right. Exactly.
Okay.
So the,
it's 14 Nisan.
14 Nisan. Yeah. So the feast of the Passover is sort of started in our time. It would be the night time of the Wednesday, but for them it's the Thursday. So it's just hard for me to, because a long time ago when I was first studying the scriptures, it was hard for me to understand how Christ actually died for 3 days, because I didn't understand that.
Right.
Because in my mind, that's not 3 days.
You're like Friday, Saturday.
Friday, Saturday, Saturday, Sunday. Resurrected Sunday, that's not 3 days.
Right.
You know? So I suppose keep in mind that when we talk. But something I did want to mention, though, the Feast of the Passover. So like you said, Christ has separated himself from the masses and the people.
Yeah.
And he actually spoke to Peter and John first. And this is what he told Peter and John. This actually starts in Luke chapter 20, and it starts in verse 10. And it's verse 10 to 13.
Luke chapter 20.
20, sorry, Luke chapter 22.
22.
22, verse 10. So okay, 22 is the start of it. So he says, and he said unto them, this is talking to Christ, talking to Peter and John, and he said unto them, behold, when ye entered into the city, there shall be a man meet you, bearing a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house where he entereth in, and ye shall go unto the good man of the house. The master saith unto thee, where is the guest chamber? Shall I eat? Where shall I eat the Passover with my disciples?
Right.
And he shall show you a large upper room furnished. Make there, make ready. And they went and found as he said unto them, and they made ready the Passover. So it's
this is the location of the Passover.
This is the location of the Passover, but Christ hadn't organized this beforehand. This is one of those things where another miracle, where Christ said, hey, if you come across this, you'll come across this guy with a jug of water. Make sure you ask that guy if he can prepare the house for the master. And it's an interesting story as well, because Bruce R. McConkie actually picks this up in The Mortal Messiah. And I just want to read it quickly. He says that there's a reason why this is the place where we're going to go. We're not going to, all right, everyone, gather to my house. I'm not going to tell anyone, but, you know, gather to my house. This is what he says. He says, no doubt, Jesus withheld the name of the place and the man for two reasons. So that Peter and John, following his instructions, would learn anew of his seeric powers, and also to keep the knowledge from Judas. So he will not be able to lead them to Jesus until after all the things had been accomplished. So if Jesus had, you know, made an announcement to all of his apostles, this is where we're going, Judas could have gone, sweet, all right, I'll prepare the soldiers, they'll come and get him then. But Jesus really needed to prepare the way so that, you know,
to do the sacrament.
Exactly. The sacrament, all the other, you know, and then the actual Garden of Gethsemane, that all needed to be done. So we need to keep this place, you know, a secret.
Right. So, okay. So he says, go find, you'll find this person, and then this person will lead you to where we're going.
Yep. This person will have this place ready.
Yeah.
It was never organized before.
And do we know who that was?
Well, actually, there is, in Christianity, there's sort of a belief that we believe
in
this person. Like a
theologian. Yeah, exactly. Belief.
Okay. It's not in scripture, and it's not doctrine, but it's a common belief that a lot of Christians have, that this man was actually Mark's father, the same Mark in the scripture, you know, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Mark.
Yep.
Because later on there's a story when Christ goes to Gethsemane and the soldiers go to find him. There's a boy there, and the boy tries to warn Jesus that they're going to come. Now, the idea is that this man with the jar of water is Mark's father taking the disciples to the house. When Judas later leaves during the Passover, and he goes to get the soldiers. Now, the story would go that Judas says, I know where he is, come with me to this house. They go to the house. The boy Mark is in the house. He's a young boy at the time.
Right.
He wakes up hearing the soldiers, knowing what they're going to do. So he gets up to try and find Jesus and warn him that the soldiers are on their way. They're looking for you. So it's a great story. It's something so small in the scriptures, but it's something so powerful.
So is that in Mark, it records that there was an attempt to take Christ earlier on. Is that occasion?
Well, in Mark, the attempt talks about how the soldiers were going to find Christ and this young boy goes to warn Christ.
Right.
So the idea is that, the young boy came from that house because that's where they were going. Because, I mean, Judas, as far as Judas knows, they're still there.
Right, sure. You know? Yeah, he thinks that. So, and then eventually then they go back, then that house is prepared for the institute of the sacrament.
That's right. Yeah. So, yep. Okay. So the jar of water, they go, Christ goes, they all go. There's 13 places set.
Yep.
You know, because obviously this man, I don't know if Mark's father had seen a vision that he needed to prepare for this. There's no story on that. So they've sat down at this table and the Passover started.
And this is where we see that Christ washes the disciples' feet.
Right? That's right, yeah.
And we haven't, this is obviously a very, a ceremonial event.
Well, that's right.
A very symbolic ceremonial event.
Yeah, there's two things that he does. The very first thing he does was institute the sacrament.
Yep.
And then, yeah, the second thing is the new ceremony of the washing of the feet. And I just want to get into the sacrament before we do that, just because it's the first thing he does.
Okay.
And that's in Luke 22, still in verse 19. He says, "And he took bread and gave thanks and brake it and said unto them, and gave unto them, saying, This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." I'm going to give up my body for the world, you know, so take the sacrament in remembrance of me, which, I mean, we hear every Sunday, we study a lot. It's a great thing. Likewise, also the cup after supper, saying, "This cup is the New Testament in my blood, which is shed for you." So, you know, I see this as, the bread is the physical body of Christ, the resurrection. The blood is the spiritual healing that Christ is going to perform. You know, altogether, it's the atonement.
I was just thinking, it's easy to read, but the feelings and the atmosphere in that room would have been exceptional.
Oh.
We'll talk about it in one second, but there's Judas is in the room as well. And Christ very well knows, in fact, he mentions it after, but he knows what's going to happen. He knows what's happening. And that you can almost feel that while their spirit is so strong, that there might also be a feeling of despair, also a feeling of sorrow, sadness. Like the disciples know that this is the end. This person that they've been with for years and that they've watched and that they've got such true knowledge of his origins and what his earthly mission is, that this is kind of the last day. I imagine it's spiritual, sad, you know, lots of mixed emotions in the room.
And the fact that, you know, Christ's whole life, he surrounded himself with everyone, you know, so he can preach the gospel. But for him to then say, I need to speak to you guys separately, you know, then, in your mind, obviously it's a sad, it's an emotional time, but really you're going, this is something I really need to pay attention to. Something important is being told to me right now. And this is one of the main crux that Christ really wants to explain to us all.
I thought I would point out the knowledge gap of the disciples to Christ.
Okay.
In John 13, Christ is washing the feet, right?
Yep.
And this is in verse 8, "Peter saith unto him, Thou shalt never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, If I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. And so Peter, not really understanding, then says, Well, don't just wash my feet then, wash my hands, wash my head. Like, if you're saying you've just got to wash my feet, well, and that makes me part of you, I want all
everything
to
all.
Be part of you. So can you just bathe me, you know? And it just shows that there's still a knowledge gap. And I think for me, it just firms up this idea that the disciples aren't trained theologians. They don't know all the ins and outs. They don't know ceremonies. They often at times can't put two and two together. So they're really, really simple people. It reminds me of the story when Joseph Smith is being called out that he's just an illiterate a farm boy.
Yeah.
And he says says something like, well, the age of the illiterate fishermen are back.
Yeah.
You know, this is these people.
Well, that's right. When Christ was calling his apostles, he didn't go to the temple and say, hey, you know, great rabbis, come to me.
Yeah.
He went to the fishermen and said, pick up your nets and come follow me.
Right.
You know, simple as that.
And I really, really like that it's not an exclusive party.
Yeah.
Like, it's symbolic as well that everyone can be a part of this. Not just those people who think they're the highest in the community who get an invite to everything.
Yep.
So, okay, so this happens, and then Christ teaches a small lesson here about that matter. Jesus answered, "He it is to whom I shall give a sop when I have dipped it, and when he had dipped the sop, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. And after the sop, Satan entered into him. Then said Jesus, unto him, Thou doest quickly." No man at the table knew for what intent he spake this unto him.
It's interesting that he says, you know, that Satan entered into him. It must have been sort of a rage that Judas, as soon as Judas was given the sop, he must have just been filled with rage then going, you're saying it's me that's going to betray you? And then probably in his mind going, how did you know it was me? But, you know, that's how I think. If Satan entered in his heart just then, to me, he's just full of rage suddenly.
And there's a pretty decent chance that Judas has already been paid.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So Judas is pretending so much. It's like a kid at home. Like they know that they have done something. They'll swear to you till the cows come home.
Yeah.
Wasn't me. And then when you finally find him out, they're annoyed.
Yeah.
In this case, Judas has absolutely done the biggest betrayal in our scriptural history.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there, even though he's most likely already got the money. He's already got a Ferrari in the driveway. And he's saying, oh, I don't know where that came from. Yeah. That wasn't me.
Yeah.
And you're right, Satan entered him. So he's almost got the money and he's then full of rage. Oh, how could you say that this was me, kind of thing.
And I guess there's no turning back at that point for him. If Satan entered him, that's it.
Well, it's done.
He's just going to go keep going with it, yeah.
Yeah. The ship has sailed now.
Yeah, exactly.
The ship has sailed. And I imagine, was he nervous? Did he feel the Spirit at all when the washing was happening or when the sacrament was being offered? But anyway, he goes. And he then, having received the sop, went immediately out, and it was night. So what we now see is Judas leaving. And I think it is in Jesus of Christ where Talmage talks about just that there must have now been a sense of relief and less people, like we now, like everyone knows it's now Judas and it's okay, that's done. And there's now going to be, now essentially the atonement is, it's now rolling.
Right.
We're now on the tracks.
Yep.
And we're on our way. And small lessons continue to occur. Christ in 34, a new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. And by this shall men know that ye are my disciples, if ye love one to another. So Christ is teaching them. And this goes on for a little bit, but I thought, and look, I've dropped my marker. But in, I think it's Matthew 26, 7 or 26.
Is this where they start sort of wrapping up the Passover?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they have the hymn?
They have a prayer, they have a hymn.
Where's that? Because I've totally pulled my marker out.
Yeah.
But they do have a hymn. They have a hymn. Anyway.
No, you're right. They do. They have a prayer, they have a hymn. And it's very, you know, the way I see it, it's sort of like a sacrament meeting.
Right.
At the end, they have this prayer, they have this hymn, and then they go with Christ to the Garden of Gethsemane.
Yes, yeah, yeah. That's right. That's exactly what I was going to say, actually. But you know what? Okay, I can't find the verse.
Okay.
But they do. It's there's essentially a closing hymn.
Yeah.
Which I find I've probably never, you know, you don't often put that together.
Yeah.
But there is they sung a song. And man, if only I could find that verse. I'll find it literally as soon as this ends.
Yeah, we'll put it up on our socials.
So they have a hymn and then they go.
Yeah.
Do you want to take us through that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a hard thing to try and explain. But yeah, I'll just explain it in the most simple terms, I suppose. So they go with Christ to the Garden of Gethsemane. And Christ essentially just tells the apostles to wait. In Luke chapter 22 now, and yep. We're going to start with verse 39, I would say.
Luke 22, verse 39.
Verse 41. And he says, "And he was withdrawn from them at about a stone's cast and kneeled down and prayed." Okay, so Christ left his apostles there and he went in prayer saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. So Christ knows what's going to happen. And it's something that we'll never comprehend. And this incredible being, if it's possible, is there a way that I can get at this? But if not, don't even worry about it.
Yeah.
Now, something amazing happens then. And it says in verse 43, and there appeared an angel unto him from heaven, strengthening him. So this angel that came down, it came to him, and it's there's actually a little thing here I want to read. It says, this is from Bruce R. McConkie, we know that an angel came down from the courts of glory to strengthen him in his ordeal, and we suppose that it was the mighty Michael, who foremost fell that mortal men may be. Now, why Michael? He's just described it right there. Why would Michael come down and be the one to strengthen Christ? Well, we talked about at the beginning, this really started from Adam and Eve falling from the garden.
Right.
Even though it was foreordained before the world was, you know, God knew that this was all going to happen. Michael, he was with Christ in the beginning. He was the one there in the Garden of Eden, the one that fell. It only makes sense that he would be the one that comes to Christ and comforts him in his time of need. Now, who knows what they spoke about? It would be a really interesting thing to know what they spoke about, but I guess that's personal between those
and,
two.
And did they even speak? Or did they just sit there together?
Possibly.
Knowing and comforting and
yeah.
just you know, being with someone you're really close with.
That's right. Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah. So Michael came down, and I've read the scripture before in one of our previous podcasts, but I want to read it again, because to me it's just the most powerful scripture in the whole Book of Mormon. In the whole scriptures that we have, and it's actually in Doctrine and Covenants.
Okay.
And it's Doctrine and Covenants section 19. And now this is Christ talking about the pain that he went through for the atonement.
What verse?
And it's verse 18. So section 19, verse 18.
Okay.
Which suffering caused myself, even God, the greatest of all, to tremble because of pain, and to bleed at every pore, and to suffer both body and spirit, and would that I might not drink the bitter cup and shrink. Nevertheless, glory to be the Father. And I partook and finished my preparations unto the children of men. So the pain that he went through, he's saying, even I, a God, you imagine this creator, the creator of the world, the one that came down on his own accord to heal the world.
Yeah.
He
raised someone from the dead.
Raised someone from the dead, healed so many miracles, and it caused him, the greatest of all, to shrink because of the pain. Now, you know, we'll never understand that, but I just want to keep going in Luke 22, so the verse 44. And being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat as if were drops, great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And when he arose up from prayer, he came to his disciples and found them sleeping for sorrow. Now, he came back to his disciples, and like I said, they were sleeping. And he sort of kind of reproves them a bit and says, you know, how can you sleep at a time like this? And he went back off and he prayed again. Now, it does say in, I think it's Mark, that Christ prayed for the first time for an hour, but then it doesn't really say how long he prayed for after that. But I did find an article in LDS Living that said that Christ started just before midnight, the atonement part in Gethsemane,
okay,
and the soldiers came around 6 in the morning. So it went for about 4 to 6 hours.
So he hasn't slept. He's physically in pain, emotionally drained. No food. No rest.
No blood, essentially. Bleeding from every pore for hours.
You're right.
To take on the pain and of the world. He was sinless. He didn't need to do this for himself. So he only did it for everyone else. So he comes back. The disciples are sleeping. He wakes them up. Then he goes back again. Who knows how long he prays for again. Comes back. The disciples are asleep again. This is all in Mark 14.
Yep.
And then he comes back for the third time and, you know, he lets them rest.
And he says, watch ye and pray. This is Mark 14, what you were just talking about. Watch ye and pray, lest ye enter into temptation. The spirit truly is ready, but the flesh is weak.
I wonder if the enter into temptation that he's speaking of there is, don't come to me. Like, he's only a stone's throw away and he's going to go through this agony. pray here that you don't enter into temptation. You don't come to me and try and stop this.
You don't try to help me and take the pain away.
Yeah, you don't try and come to me. This is something I have to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
because what else could the temptation be? Not that's walk off and go kill someone like that.
Yeah, I mean, they're with someone that they love so dearly, and they would know that he's in pain. They certainly know what's happening.
Yeah.
And so, of course, your immediate reaction is, how can I stop this?
Even your enemy, if you saw what they were going through, you'd go and you'd try and stop them. So you imagine someone you love so dearly, yeah.
Yeah. And that's what... And so I guess the temptation is, well, that's what Satan would have really wanted.
Yep.
He would want the disciples to go and stop that from happening and let Christ get arrested. And
exactly. And not fulfill what he was there to fulfill.
Okay.
Yeah. So... I was actually going to skip a little bit here and talk about Pilate just briefly.
Okay.
Do you have something?
No, that's great.
So I'm going to flick again because...
I'm still frustrated I couldn't find the verse about the...
Okay.
Yep.
So I'm going to flick again because the Bible's really annoying like this. And it's John chapter 18. And there was this really, really good movie the church brought out called To This End Was I Born. And
okay.
It's about the atonement, and it's really, really good. And it references the scripture here. So I'm going to start in verse 36,
right,
and then go on. So Pilate is now speaking with Christ, and we're just going to skip around the Pilate thing real quick because there's so much to talk about. And he says, so Pilate's asking him, you know, aren't thou a king? And he says, and Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. For if my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight, that I should not be delivered to the Jews? But now is my kingdom not from hence? Pilate therefore said unto him, art thou a king then? Jesus answered, thou sayest that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness unto the truth. Every one that is of the truth heareth my voice. Christ was born for this purpose, for this atonement. He's saying, my kingdom isn't of this world, it's of the next life. But to this end was I born. For this conclusion was I born, why I am here.
So he was teaching Pilate without Pilate probably realizing that he would, for him to be judged right now, for what he's going through right now, that's why I'm here.
That's why I'm here. Yeah, exactly.
This is the reason I'm here. And Pilate probably wouldn't understand that, I would imagine. But he knows he's not a bad guy. He says, you know, later he symbolically washes his hands and says,
yeah,
I find no fault.
Exactly. You know, this is on you. You want to crucify him? I don't. I'm washing my hands of this. Yeah.
So he's trying to teach him a lesson that he was born to do what's happening right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And then he's like we said, he is then charged and the Jewish people want to crucify him. And Pilate says, well, I'm not going to have anything to do with this. He gives him an opportunity, says we can let this guy go free.
Yeah, it's up to you.
But of course he doesn't.
Yeah.
And then he goes and he's arrested and he's put through just the most horrible punishments. He's whipped, he's spat on, he has a crown of thorns. He goes through so much pain that people, normal humans, don't survive that pain. It's almost like they're trying to push him over the edge so they don't even have to go through with the crucifixion. They're trying to kill him before that happens. But Christ hangs on, and he's got a mission to fulfill, and he's not going to give up the ghost until the crucifixion actually occurs.
Well, that's right, and they clearly don't understand the doctrine because Christ is, you know, physical because of his mother Mary, but from his father in heaven, he's got this ability to only die when he says it's his time, when he's completely fulfilled his father's work, when he gives up the ghost. So it's only makes sense in my mind that his body was near the brink of death from when he left the Garden of Gethsemane. You know, because no one could survive that. And then, like you said, then with all the punishments.
Yeah.
Then when he was hung on the cross, you know, normally you would suffocate to death because the way that you hung up. Bruce McConkie, you know, he says it a few times that he was nailed to the cross with Roman nails by the Jewish people. And he repeats that a few times, actually. It's really powerful that, you know, his own people could do this to him from the things that they've seen, just like we spoke about before. But yeah, he's hung on the cross. A lot of things happen while he's on the cross, actually. Again, it's a lot of back and forth. So Matthew talks about one bit, Luke talks about another bit, and John talks about another bit. So if we're up to that part, can I read that? Yep. Okay. So we're going to skip around. So actually, do you want to look at John chapter 19, verse 26 to 27?
Oh, already got it.
Perfect. All right. And I will go to Matthew 27. So I'll read Matthew 27 first, and then we'll read your part.
I'm John 19, 26, 27?
That is correct. So okay. I'm on Matthew 27, 46, and this is the first part.
Right.
And about the ninth hour, this is while he's up on the cross. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, and I'm not going to read that part because I'm going to butcher it and I really want to get the point across.
Okay.
That is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And there was this really, really good talk, and I wish I had found it, about this part. And this is where Christ needed to understand. So he's sunk lower than people. He's taken on the sins of the world, but this he really needs to understand what it's like not to have the Spirit of God with him. And at this point, he says, my God, what hast thou forsaken me? But his work, it needs to continue. So if you want to read...
So this is the... Are we in the depths now? Is this the absolute bottom?
This is the absolute bottom.
Like, it's... It's 12 hours, more than 12 hours of just absolute torture.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. This is the Friday
night. No sleep, no food, and then absolute physical and emotional punishment.
Yep. So you read your part.
And when Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple standing by whom he loved, he saith unto his mother, Woman, behold thy son. Then saith he to the disciple, Behold thy mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her unto his own home.
So, I mean, I couldn't imagine that. So Christ is on the cross. His mother's there. He's speaking to her. That's the last sort of thing that he says, the last thing he wants to clear up. Take care of my mother. And then this is the last part he says in Luke 23, verse 46. And when Jesus had cried with a loud voice, he said, Father, into thy hands I commend my spirit. And having said thus, he gave up the ghost. So it was at that stage when he finally finished his work,
yep.
The atonement, he gave up the ghost. I mean, that part of the atonement, there's still a bit more that we're going to talk about. But now he's able to let his spirit be separated from his body.
That work, that physical body of Christ work is done at that point.
Exactly.
And importantly to note that it was done in his time, only when he knew... And how he knew, I'm not sure we'll know, but at that point he knew he had suffered enough.
Yep.
He suffered enough for us.
He suffered to the bottom, the absolute bottom. Yeah. Yep. And now it was time to give up the ghost.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, and just like everyone else, immediately as soon as he died, he went to the spirit world, didn't he?
Right. Yeah. Well, why don't you take that? I mean, that's a great story. Why don't you take us through that? So Christ has died and he's now in the spirit world, and that's in Peter.
Well, it is. It's in, again, I mean, the Bible's not complete, so it's really hard to understand. But if you want to look at 1 Peter, chapter 3, 18 to 19, and I'm going to look at Doctrine and Covenants that explains what you're about to read, because, you know, we need an explanation.
Yes.
So you read that and then I'll...
Peter 3, 18 and 19.
1 Peter 3, 18 and 19. Yep, absolutely.
For Christ also hath once suffered for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but quickened by the Spirit, by which also he went and preached unto the spirits in prison.
Yep, that's correct. So Christ died as we die. And then he went to the spirit world and he preached the spirits in prison. Now,
being put to death in the flesh, but quickened in the spirit, by which also he went and preached unto the spirits in prison.
Right. So as soon as his spirit separated from his body, he went to the spirit world to preach. Now, there's a really, really good section of the Doctrine and Covenants, section 138. And this is Joseph F. Smith. He actually read that. And when he read that, he prayed about it and had a vision of the spirit world. So in section 138, this is the vision. Well, I'm not going to read. You should definitely read the whole thing. It's really, really good. But I'm just going to note down verse 29 to 31.
Okay.
He says, And as I wondered, my eyes were opened and my understanding quickened. And I perceived that the Lord went not in prison among the wicked and the disobedient who had rejected the truth to teach them. But behold, from among the righteous, he organized his forces and appointed messengers, clothed with power and authority, and commissioned them to go forth and carry the light of the gospel to them that were in darkness, even to all the spirits of men. And thus was the gospel preached to the dead, and the chosen messengers went forth to declare the acceptable day of the Lord, to proclaim liberty to the captives who are bound, even unto all who would repent of their sins and receive the gospel. So Christ organized the spirit world at this stage. He went, and he didn't actually go to the spirit prison, which what we understand the spirit prison to be, the wicked people. He actually went to the what we just call now the spirit paradise,
right.
And he went to the righteous people, and he organized them. This is what you need to teach. This is the doctrine that you need to go and teach these other people. It's great.
So he went and, yeah, okay.
Yeah, so he went and preached to the righteous spirits. And now, in the spirit world, it is organized in a way that the righteous go and teach the unrighteous. And that's why we have baptisms for the dead. You know, as soon as they accept it, the missionary works happen on the other side of the veil. We do baptisms for the dead. When they accept it, when they're taught, then it's, you know, the spirit of
so
prophecy.
They're taught it that because, yeah, they're taught by the people in paradise, spirit paradise.
Exactly, that have died. Yeah.
Okay, so we then have the final chapter, I guess, the Garden of the Empty Tomb.
Right.
And this is the completion of the atonement.
Yep.
So the disciples go, and do we want to quickly talk about Joseph of Arimathea?
Joseph of Arimathea, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so in Luke 23, verse 50, and behold, there was a man named Joseph, a counselor, and he was a good man, and it was his tomb that he gave to Christ, but Christ's body. It explains it better in Mark, I think, but he essentially gives he gives up his tomb for Christ, being a believer in what's going to happen.
He's a disciple of Christ. He knows the doctrine. And yeah, he was a rich man, wasn't he?
He was.
So Joseph of Arimathea, he had this tomb. Rich people had owned their own tombs back in those days. Regular people didn't. So Joseph of Arimathea willingly gave up his tomb, knowing that Christ wouldn't need it for very long anyway. So he's still going to be able to use it, you know, I presume. So, but he gave up his tomb for Christ. So Christ was buried in the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea.
And then we have this amazing vision in our heads as we read Matthew 28. In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn towards the first day of the week, came Mary Magdalene and the other Mary to the sepulchre.
I say sepulchre, but I'm always corrected. Sorry.
Okay. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for the angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone from the door and sat upon it. His countenance was like lightning and his raiment white as snow. And for fear of him, the keepers did shake and became as dead men. And this is where he says, he is not here, for he is risen. As he said, come see the place where the Lord lay. So they go in and they see that there's no body. There's no anything there. And the napkin is, right, symbolically folded.
Yeah, well, it says here, and the napkin that was about his head, not laying with the linen cloth, but wrapped together into place by itself. And after seeing that, it says, then went in also the other disciples who came before to the sepulchre, and he saw and believed. And yet, that is important because it was Jewish etiquette that if anyone enjoyed their fellowship meal with their friends, the custom is to fold the napkin neatly and place it to one side of the setting. So if you read that with this in mind, Jesus' resurrection, he's folded his napkin to say that
it's done.
It's done. This I am done now. This is it, and I will return, you know, to be with him, to be with them.
So they see Christ, and they realize, they believe. And essentially then, unless there's anything else you want to go through, this is where we tie it into the Book of Mormon.
That's right. Yeah.
He says, I need to go and visit all the people.
Yep.
And does he visit just the Nephites?
Well, in the third Nephi, I wish I'd found it beforehand, he does say that he's got to go visit more people.
Yeah.
You know, you're not the only ones. And so he does visit more people. And, I mean, that's a story in itself, and we'll eventually get to that in 3rd Nephi. We can really focus on it.
Sure.
But again, like, where does it end? You know, we talked about how does it begin. Where does it end?
I think we've got through enough. I think we've got through enough.
Yep.
Well, we're grateful for everyone who's been able to join with us today. We have, we've reached the conclusion of our Easter lesson, and we enjoyed going through it. And I just want to end on... on our thoughts that we, you know, we are grateful for the atonement and we're grateful for this time of year, and we really encourage you to look at the lesson and look at all of the bits that we haven't talked about and really try and grow your knowledge and join the gaps as well. There's things that happen every single day that lead up to this event that will hopefully fill you with the Spirit and help you grow your own testimony. And with that, then we'll see you for another episode at another time.
Yeah, definitely. We'll see you next week.
Thank you.